The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast.
Richard D. Wolfe is a professor of economics emeritus, University of Massachusetts, Amherst. He also taught economics at Yale and at the City College of the City of New York. He is a founder of the Association of Economic and Social Analysis and the host of the weekly radio and TV program, Economic Update. Professor Richard Wolfe, welcome to the Zero Books channel.
Thank you, Douglas. Glad to be here.
Yeah, now you have a new book that is just come out or is coming out. It's The Sickness.
It's very long. It's called The Sickness is the System. When capitalism cannot save us from pandemics or itself.
Right. And you, you've published this with an organization called, Democracy at Work.
That's right. Democracy at Work. And you can find out anything you might be interested in by simply going to the website, democracyatwork.info, where the books, and because there are multiple books, not just that one, that's the most recent one, and all kinds of other materials of the sort that we produce and disseminate, all of that's available freely at the website.
So what is Democracy at Work, and how did this particular book come together?
Well, Democracy at Work and the book are the product of a small group of people that I have gathered around myself over the years, and that are committed to basically doing two things. Number one, offering a sustained criticism of capitalism. In other words, to look at the kinds of problems our society has, whether they be those kinds of problems exposed by the Me Too movement or the Black Lives Matter movement, or the terrible failure of coping with this pandemic, or what we saw in Texas a few weeks ago with the collapse of their electricity system and all of the suffering, the ecological issues. I could list them, but your audience knows what they are.
I think you almost have listed them all, but maybe yeah. I'm being optimistic.
Right. And our goal has always been not to repeat the criticisms of these particular issues, but to make a particular critical argument that the way to understand them, and thus the way to overcome them and solve them, requires that you see them as symptoms of a system, that they are not individual problems that are going to be fixed by some Band-Aid, by some new rule, by some new law, by some new politician. They run deeper than that. It's not even to find fault with the politicians, although we do that. That's not the focus. The focus is, let me use a metaphor. Your refrigerator keeps breaking down, and you call the refrigerator repair people, and they send someone. And the nice young man or woman that they send, after a while, takes you aside and says, look, yeah, I can fix it again, but you will be calling us 2 to 3 to 4 weeks from now, and you'll have us back here again. And it'll cost you a couple $100 each time that we come out here and fix the motor or adjust the condenser or whatever. It's time to get a new fridge. Yeah, it'll set you back more, but in the long run, it's the wiser move, even financially. That's our argument. Mm-hmm. Capitalism had a good run. It's been around for 300 or 400 years. It has some things it accomplished that no one will deny, but it is run out of gas. It's a system that now is really good for the top 5% of the people and really not good for pretty much everybody else. And that's why we're divided as a country. That's why we're having the problems we are. And fixing it one more little adjustment here or there won't do, just like with that refrigerator. So it's a systemic criticism. And the other half of what we do is to offer a solution. We do not want to be, you know, raining on everybody's parade with a criticism if we don't have something to say. And the answer we offer is to say that the way to change the system so it doesn't work this way is to go to the root. And for us, the root is the enterprise, the workplace, the factory, the office, the store, where we produce the goods and services that are our economy. And the problem there, we argue, is clear. It is undemocratic. A very small group of people in every office, every factory, every store, the owner, if it's a corporation, the board of directors, usually 10 or 15 people, they make all the decisions. What to produce, what technology to use, where to carry out the production, and what to do with whatever profits the enterprise generates. That tiny people does that for themselves, which should surprise nobody. The mass of us, the employees, the vast majority, have to live with the consequences of the decisions we are excluded from making. And the people making the decisions are not accountable to us. The workers have nothing to say about who the boss is. It goes the other way. The boss hires and fires you. You don't hire and fire the boss. And so our argument is simple. Let's democratize the enterprise. In a country that celebrates itself as being, quote unquote, democratic, it is bizarre that from the beginning, the enterprise, the workplace, has been excluded. When you cross the threshold into your job, you give up your democratic rights. You allow other people to tell you what to do, how to do it, when to do it, where to do it. And at the end of the day, you leave behind what you helped to produce and you go home to rest and recuperate so you can do it all again tomorrow. And for us, this non-democratic workplace is the problem. And to democratize it is the solution. One last point. Okay. If all the workers, just to illustrate, if all the workers in every workplace, one person, one vote, what we do in the communities where we reside, you know, where we live, where our homes are, if we did that at the workplace, and do remember that the workplace is where we spend most of our adult lives, 5 out of the 7 days, the best hours of the day, we are mostly at work. So it's not a minor matter how you organize work. And if it were democratized, if we did have one person, one vote, here's what would happen. We would distribute the income each of us gets from our work in a way that was equitable. Some would be paid more. Maybe they worked harder. Maybe they worked in conditions that were difficult. Maybe they spent a longer time acquiring certain skills. Who knows? But what we would not do is give a handful of people billions of dollars while the rest of us can't send our kids to college. That wouldn't happen. No democratic community ever did or would do that kind of thing. And so I think problems like, for example, the inequality that this country suffers from, that the vast majority of Americans say is a problem that they would like to be solved. Well, we haven't solved it, but the democratization of the enterprise could do that.
Well, what I hope to talk about for the remainder of our time together here is just exactly how that refrigerator works and why it breaks down so often.
Okay.
I'm hoping we can break this into two conversations, one about your book that's coming out now, and one about some of the writings that you've done in the past with Stephen Resnick. Particularly, there was an essay between state and private capitalism that I wanted to touch upon.
Good.
But before we get to that stuff, which will be something I put out for people who pay to get the second, you know, the rarefied stuff for the patrons, it will be in the Parrot Room. I want to ask you about your career, actually, and how you came to be as famous as you are. It seems to me that you've been in the Marxist left. You've been teaching economics, certainly, since the early 70s. You've probably been part of the Marxist left even a little longer than that. But it wasn't until after you retired or after the economic crisis that you became widely known, at least as far as I was concerned. You became much more famous and much more called upon to speak after the economic crash of 2007. And I was just wondering, like, what you think of what's happened over the last 14 years and since you've become more of a public, widely known figure.
Sure, I'd be glad to talk about that. A little of the background. I'm the child of immigrants. That is, I was born in Youngstown, Ohio, so I'm as American as that makes me. Mm-hmm. I've lived all my life and worked all my life here in the United States, and I'm glad that I have. My mother was German, and my father was French, and I grew up speaking both French and German, which I still do. I learned English when my parents deposited me in the kindergarten, and I suddenly had to speak the language that everybody else had to speak. And when you're 5 years old, apparently your brain is such that you pick up languages very quickly and very easily. And I've done all my adult work in English. One of the consequences of being the child of immigrants is that, especially if the parents were immigrants out of necessity, not so much out of choice. My parents were running away from the Second World War to survive. And so they had to kind of start all over here in the United States. And they wanted to achieve the success that life had denied them because they had to move their culture, their home, their family through their children, in this case, me and my sister. And the result is you are driven in a way that is a mixed blessing, to be as honest as the moment requires. Mm-hmm. But one of the consequences was that I had to please my parents to be good in school. And that way to somehow be successful, because that's what they wanted me to be, as much for me, but even more, I think, for them. Anyway, long story short, I'm the product of the elite schools of the United States. I went to Harvard as an undergraduate. Then I went to Stanford to get my master's degree. And I finished up at Yale University. So I spent 10 years of my life at Harvard, Stanford, and Yale, arguably among the best universities the country has. And here's what I learned at that tender age. That 19 out of the 20 semesters, two semesters a year for 10 years, 19 out of those 20 semesters spent in those three institutions, I was taught that the economic system we lived in, capitalism, here in the United States, was absolutely the best thing since sliced bread. It was the greatest economic system imaginable. It was the highest achievement of the human race. We should all be grateful and thankful that we were so lucky as to live in the country that best exemplified just how far capitalism can go. And while some of that was persuasive to me, I had a kind of a general notion that I wasn't getting quite the whole story. I had the idea that there were no doubt critics of capitalism. And I got that idea partly from my parents, partly from the people that they brought to the house that I encountered, some of whom were critics of capitalism, either in Europe or here. And I knew enough to know that there was a tradition of critical thinking, and it bothered me that I never heard about it at Harvard, Stanford, or Yale, except for one semester, a professor at Stanford in California, who did expose us to Marxism. And Marxism, he explained in class, was the most developed critique of capitalism that he knew of. And so he wanted us to read the best there was to see whether we found anything in there interesting or insightful or useful. And again, to make a long story short, I did. And as I found useful things in reading Marx, so my upset about having been denied that at Harvard and my upset at then being denied it later at Yale deepened. So by the time I graduated, had my PhD in economics from Yale, I already knew that I was going to be a critic of the system in a way that my teachers had not understood or allowed for. Certainly none of them really knew much about it. And many of my teachers were very good teachers and were good economists. But when it came to criticism, they were, to be as nice as I can, out to lunch. They weren't there. They hadn't been there when the handouts were given to learn about it.
What kind of economic theories were you mostly learning at that time? Was it Keynesian?
Keynesian economics, because when I was a graduate student, the United States was still living in the wake of the Great Depression. You have to remember that from 1929 to 1941, American capitalism collapsed. There's no other way to put it. It was called the Great Crash for a reason, because it was a great crash. 1933, for example, the peak unemployment officially in the United States, 25%. One out of every four members of the working population of this country was without work. That means that every single family in America either had mama or papa or Uncle Harry or Aunt Louise or Cousin Jim out of work. And there was then no unemployment insurance for most of that time. So they had to lean on the rest of the family at a time when the jobs of the rest of the family were also in trouble and their incomes were in trouble. It was a time of terrible suffering for a population that had not been prepared for this, had been told that capitalism is an upward and onward growth engine. Yeah, very nice story, but it wasn't in the 1930s. And as 29 became 30 and 31 and 32 and 33, it didn't go away. And it didn't go away for the entire 12 years from 1929 to 1941. And it was really only World War II that put everybody back to work. It took half the unemployed and put them in the military, and the other half producing the uniforms, guns, and bullets that the military used. This kind of a situation produced in this country a notion that the government has to come in and save private capitalism from itself. And my professors taught us how, why, when, and where the government needs to step in, not as a criticism of capitalism, but to preserve capitalism, to save it, to make it work better than it did if you didn't have the government step in, because if the government didn't step in, it would collapse. By the way, that's what the last year and a half has retaught the American people. When that pandemic hit, this system didn't work. We have 4% of the world's population in the United States and 20% of the world's dead people from COVID-19. For a rich country, for a country with a well-developed medical system, there's no excuse and there's no easy explanation except that a system isn't working. So I became a critic.
Yeah, I want to talk to you about COVID and the current economic crisis, but I do want you to finish your story, and I'm interested to see how it leads up to 2008 or 2009.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
If I hadn't gone to those fancy universities, you probably wouldn't be talking to me today. I don't want to put myself down, but I'm not any more smarter and brighter than the next person. And I really mean that. But once you go to those kinds of fancy universities, this is a country very hung up on pedigree, very hung up on prestige, on ranking. And with my kinds of pedigrees, all kinds of universities were willing to hire me despite the fact that I was critical. despite the fact that if you ask me whether I learned something from Marxism and socialism, I would look you right in the eye and say, yes, I learned a lot, and I'm not going to deny it or fake it or pretend that I didn't. Yes, it will hurt my career a little bit, but I don't have to be dishonest, and I don't want to be.
Were you a part of the student movements that were going on in the 60s?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Including something that set up the Union for Radical Political Economics, which was a kind of alternative to the American Economic Association, which is the official kind of association that economists, particularly in universities and colleges, join. We set up something called URPE, U-R-P-E, Union of Radical Political Economists, as our kind of protest. We wanted something that was more open to criticism than the American Economic Association, which was closed to it then, as it is closed to it right now.
Not to date you, but when were you getting your PhD? Was it in the early and mid-60s, or was it the late 60s?
The late. I got my PhD at Yale, 1969.
Okay, so you were there right at the peak, or right after the peak of the anti-war
movement. That's right. That's right. And I don't mind telling you, when I finished at Yale, my first job offer, you'll laugh, my first job offer was at Johns Hopkins University, which is another Ivy League school in Baltimore. And then I got a job offer from the International Monetary Fund and from the Exxon Corporation, all of which offered me loads of prestige and loads of money.
Yeah.
And I turned.
And you didn't mind that you were a Marxist at all, or that you had been a student radical?
No, they could care less. I don't know. To tell you the truth, I'm not sure they even knew, but they probably did. But yeah, it didn't bother them at all. They knew what they wanted me to do. They had a long history of hiring people out of these institutions like me. If anything, I had more pedigree than most of those they had hired before, because I didn't go to either Harvard or Yale. I actually had degrees from both of them, blah, blah, blah. I turned those jobs down, and I took as a job a professor at the City College of the City University of New York, a job with much less money and much less prestige. And I did it because in those years, they had for the first time something called open admissions. And what the City University did was to say, any student who has a B average in high school, B or better, will be allowed to come to the university. If you can't make the grade and pass the courses, that's a different matter. But in terms of entrance to the university, you're in. And I thought that was a democratic opening of the university. I loved it. It meant that Black and Brown and Hispanic and Chinese, all the many minorities that make up the city of New York, or a large part of it, would have an opportunity they had not had before. In those days, by the way, City University of New York was free. It had been free for 100 years. A good university now opening itself with no cost. I loved it. I wanted to be a part of it. So you could see I'm launched there on a critical perspective. I then got hired at the University of Massachusetts, which is where Harvard is located. You may remember. They love to hire people who went to Harvard. It's a habit in Massachusetts. If I didn't have those pedigrees, I don't think these jobs would have come my way. And I think that that's been true right to this present. If you have the pedigree, then they will hire you, even if they're a little nervous about where your brain is taking you in terms of your critical perspective. And then when we come up to 2008, the conditions I had at the University of Massachusetts, where I was a very long time, from 1973 to 2008, a long time, 35 years, when the conditions there changed at the University of Massachusetts, so that my critical approach was being limited, hemmed in a way it had not for 35 years, I decided that I wanted the freedom to do the kinds of teaching and writing that I'm able to do. And that this was not a good atmosphere for me. So I retired, even though I'm healthy and had nothing to do with age. I retired. The New School University in New York City very kindly invited me to teach there on a part-time visiting professor basis. So that would give me more time to do the kind of writing. Choosing 2008, which I did for personal reasons, coincidentally opened me up to be a non-academic just as the capitalist crash of 2008 came down in on the United States, creating an interest in a critical understand. People were suffering, as you may remember, the so-called subprime mortgage crash of the second half of 2008 was a real shocker to Americans who had once again been led to believe that capitalism doesn't break down. Well, it did, as it does periodically anyway, and always has. But here it was, and suddenly people began to look around for who could explain the breakdown. What you had was an economics profession which were cheerleaders for this system. And so it wasn't easy to find people who had an explanation for breakdown, for a critical look. And suddenly the appetite was there, and I benefited from being one of the few people around who could satisfy that particular appetite. And it's been upward and onward ever since. My first radio show was in 2011, and in March. So this marks literally my 10th anniversary. And it's now not just a radio show in New York City, which is how it began. The program is broadcast on over 100 radio stations across the country. It is carried as a television program on a half a dozen networks and goes to over 50 million households. So, I mean, it has come a long way. But that's not because of me. That's because this country has changed and the audience and the interest is exploding. And I'm simply a little leaf carried along by that very big river.
Yeah. I started podcasting in 2009, just on... I was working at a call center and got an iPod for the first time. And I started podcasting around that time. And it was because of the economic crisis that I did that. I had a book deal from my first novel at the same time. And I was worried that all of New York was going to fall into the crapper and that everything was going to go away. And so I started podcasting and I started interviewing economists of different stripes to figure out what was going on. And quickly decided I wanted to talk to Marxists and started reading Marx around that time. And I was already 38 years old. I mean, I was an anarchist type before, you know, I would read like Z Magazine and I was a fan of Noam Chomsky, but I hadn't ever really cracked Marx. And so I started reading Marx around that time, got involved with a Marxist sect around that time. And then ended up here at Zero Books as the publishing manager in 2014. So I can say that, you know, and I've also seen over that period of time a huge explosion in the amount of far left and Marxist content that's been produced online. Right. But it's really been since 2016 that there's been a real explosion of interest in the far left online and a lot of content being created and people making real careers out of doing that kind of work. Do you think that we can look back over the last 14 years and really see a lot of progress on the left, or do you feel defeated? Because I kind of mostly feel defeated after Sanders, and I'm wondering, am I just perverse or am I missing the big picture here? So what do you think?
Let me answer it this way. I am, I've taught Marxian economics all my adult life. And it's because I love the subject and I want people to have the exposure to it. But I'm also a student of the philosopher who taught Marx. There's really no way to get around that, because if you really throw yourself into it, you learn that every great writer that you might encounter is himself or herself the product of umpteen other writers and influences. So in a way, you're entering a community. And one of the greatest teachers Marx ever had was Hegel, the German philosopher Hegel. Mm-hmm. And one of the great contributions of Hegel is called the dialectic, the understanding that everything is complicated in a particular way. He called it the unity of opposites. In simple English, every good thing has a bad thing attached to it. Every good thing has a bad aspect, and vice versa. Every bad event has the silver lining, the good side. And that if you want to understand things, you know that. And so you look to see. You're not blinded by thinking it's only one or the other. So to answer your question, I am thrilled by some of the enormous achievements that the left has made in the United States over the last few years that you specify. I'm also frustrated and upset at the fact that they haven't made in other areas anything like that kind of progress. So let me explain. When it comes to re-entering into a dialogue with the criticism of capitalism built up over the last 150 years in the Marxian intellectual and political traditions, which is the richest tradition. Let's remember, Marx dies in 1883. So we're literally 140 years since the death of this fellow. He wrote a bunch of stuff. That stuff has spread into every country on the face of this planet in the last 140 years. That's stunning. In every country, people read this stuff and said, oh boy, does this speak to our situation? So they translated it and they discussed it. So in every country, there are Marxist professors, Marxist labor union, Marxist political parties, Marxist study groups, Marxist literature emerging, Marxist internet. I mean, it's amazing that you'd have to look at Islam or Christianity or other great intellectual movements to see anything comparable to the global dispersion in record time of this set of ideas. The notion that this isn't something core to our period of human history strikes me as silly. Of course it is. And it's therefore something that you need to engage. It's the richest tradition of criticism, not just theoretical intellectual criticism, but it's a compendium of what Marxist-inspired activists have done literally in every country, one way or another, political action, revolutionary action, all of it. So I am thrilled that Americans have crawled out from the cave they were living in intellectually. The Cold War did this number on the country after 45, that not only were you to be against the Soviet Union, our erstwhile ally in World War II, but you were supposed to take this criticism or hostility of the Soviet Union to such a point that you wouldn't read the books, that you wouldn't scour the literature for whatever it might teach you. Mm-hmm. That's not smart. That's stupid. That's childish. It's infantile. The fact that my professors at Harvard and Yale could not answer my questions that were Marxist questions is a testimony. These are smart young men and women, my teachers, in many cases. This is not a failure of their capability or anything like that. It was taboo. It was fear that kept them from knowing this material. Fear. I could see it in their faces when I would ask a question. Their eyes were saying to me, please move on to something else. I don't want to be talking about this in class. It'll get back to some senior professor and my career here will be over, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. So I think it's wonderful that there's all this thing. You know, I wrote a book with my colleague, Steve Resnick, whose name you mentioned before. Mm-hmm. Before he died, one of the last books we wrote, published by MIT Press, you know, a very prestigious place for economists. Mm-hmm. Many people think it was and remains the number one economics department in the United States, or even the world, perhaps. They published a book Steve and I wrote called Contending Economic Theories. It's a comparative study of neoclassical, Keynesian, and Marxian economics. That book is used as a teaching device around the United States. That's an amazing thing. That couldn't have happened before. that MIT would publish such a book, that professors around the country would think that it's useful to have their students read such a book, et cetera, et cetera. These are things that I'm proud of and that I think are wonderful. And all the content you speak about, I agree with that over and over again. Here's what disappoints me. The left is terribly disorganized here in the United States. It does not understand the need to be organized, to have groups that work with each other, individuals that, yes, give away a little bit of their personal freedom to have the greater social impact that numbers give you. What every other organization, whether it be a church or an army or a corporation, what they all understand is the advantages you get from working together, even though that means you have to be co-respective, you have to follow rules, you have to defer to some people sometimes if they are going to be deferring to you at other moments. This notion of organization has been beaten out of the left in this country, probably by the whole Cold War experience. And so we are politically backward. We are disorganized. And the social impact of the left, even as it grows, even as it becomes more educated and sophisticated in its understanding, is hampered, is hamstrung by its failure to understand organization and the need for it. And I don't mean organization in some caricatured, you know, a notion of dictatorial leadership. And all, I understand the anarchist critique that you have to understand the need for spontaneity and you have to understand the need for individual discretion and freedom. I respect all of that, but I don't see that as an either or. I think the trick is, how do you get the benefits of organization without paying the cost of where organization can, if you're not sensitive, lead? And that lesson, I think the left just has not yet learned.
Well, in our second conversation, which is coming up pretty soon in the Parrot Room, we'll talk a little bit about particularly, I guess, the Bolsheviks and state capitalism. I'm interested to talk to you about that. But I want to get a couple of things that are really current on the table before we wrap up the first section here. And this is the main thing. You in your book, you claim that the current economic crisis is not first and foremost about COVID. So I'm wondering why you say that. I mean, I know in broad terms why you would say that, but I'm wondering if you can give me some particular indicators that a crisis was coming that happened that you saw before the right. COVID outbreak. And then, the other thing I'm wondering is if you think that when COVID is conquered, which I think will be coming up this year, I mean, I think by June or July, we're going to really see the dissipation of the virus. Do you expect that there will be a boom? And if so, why? And if not, why not?
Good. All right. Very quickly about the why I don't want to call it a COVID crisis, even though other people do. There's a long run and a short run reason. Here's the long run. Capitalism replaces feudalism, at least in Europe, usually dated around the 17th century, 17th and 18th century. It starts in England, it moves from England to Western Europe, North America, Japan, and eventually becomes the global system we know it to be today. During that time, 300 plus years, in every place where capitalism settled, it has a periodic crisis. It's called crisis, or boom bust, or recession, or depression, or crash. I could go on. We have many words for it because it is so repetitive, so regular, so much an intrinsic part of capitalism. Mm-hmm. The Bureau of National Economic Research in this country has done the dating, follows and asks the question, how often? And the answer is, on average, every 4 to 7 years, everywhere. That's an average. So sometimes it happens in less than 4 years. Sometimes it takes 10 or 20 years even you can have. But the periodicity is ensconced even in the textbooks where it is given the more neutral name business cycle. Well, whatever you call it, it is a breakdown. Every few years, suddenly large numbers of people are thrown out of work. Large numbers of businesses go belly up, bankrupt. Other businesses cut back on production. Cities and towns in the United States suddenly discover that their tax revenue is going into the toilet because all those people unemployed don't pay taxes. All those businesses belly up don't pay taxes. And so suddenly the cities and towns and the federal government too cannot provide public services, which is very strange because it's in an economic downturn that people need more in the way of public services. But in our screwy system, when they need it more is just when the governments can't produce it, leading them then to borrow money because they don't have the taxes to sustain public services. That then runs them into government debts, which cost interest payments, which then come out of the children, blah, blah, blah. This reality is part of capitalism. Now, let's do the math. In this new century, the 21st century, we are 20 years in. Okay, we've had three crises, dot-com crisis in 2000, subprime so-called in 2008, COVID in 2020. Three crises, 20 years, bingo, right on schedule.
And each one seems to be getting worse. Am I wrong on that?
In the last 3 years, no question. I mean, if you go back further, it's a little bit more uneven. But yes, in this century, each one is much worse than the previous. Look, everybody in the business community knows this. If I had time, I would show you from the Wall Street Journal or Business Week or any Bloomberg News. I can show you in 2016, 17, 18, 19. They were all written articles all the time. When is the boom going to bust? When is the bubble going to burst? When is the downturn coming? They all know this, what I've just mentioned to you. They knew it was coming. The only thing you didn't know was exactly when. Nobody can make that kind of prediction. Oh, you didn't know what the trigger would be.
Have you seen The Big Short?
Yes.
The Big Short. Yeah. So in that movie, there were guys, you know, in finance that thought they could see, you know, like exactly where things were going on. There's a guy who became famous. He was played by Batman in the movie for knowing that the mortgage crisis was coming. What kinds of things were people concerned about before COVID that were indicators to them that there was a crisis coming?
Oh, there were several. Number one, perhaps, was the absurd, for many people, the absurd so-called quantitative easing programs of the Federal Reserve. What the United States Central Bank, which is what the Federal Reserve is, what the Central Bank had been doing all the way since 2000, in terror that we would have a major depression already from the dot-com crash in early 2000, and ever after, for the last 20 years, there's been the anxiety that the American economy is weak and unstable, and that therefore a serious depression threatens us. And one of the reactions, the one that became the dominant policy reaction of both Republicans and Democrats in power, was to use monetary policy, not so much fiscal policy. That was used short term, immediately after 2000. Immediately in 2008 and 2009, and again now a little bit. But it was mostly monetary policy that was relied on. A massive increase in the money circulating, printed and produced by the Federal Reserve, which can do so, and an effort coordinated with that to drive down interest rates to near zero, which is what we've had. And the result of that led many people to say, oh my goodness, where is all that money going? Well, it isn't going into producing goods and services because our economy does not have enough people with enough spending power to make that worthwhile. So the money doesn't go where you might have hoped it would go. Where is it going instead? It's going into the stock market, which has experienced crazy upswings, including right now, of the value of stocks, because all of that money being printed by the Federal Reserve is flowing into buying stocks, selling them a few months later, buying some more. And so everybody began to say, or not everybody, but almost, that the place where this economy is going to tank is in this crazed stock market, which is wildly overvalued. The prices of stocks are out of whack with the historical trends that we've seen for two centuries, and this is not going to end well. There were loads of stories like that. Here's a second reason, and this scares people, but there's no way out of it. The United States has in it a huge number of mega corporations who started in the 1970s to say to themselves, look, we've accommodated the working class here in the United States for two centuries. We have raised their wages. We have made money off of them because we've raised their productivity even more than we've raised their wages. But we now pay very high wages. But in the 1970s, two inventions happened. The jet engine, which means we can fly to any corner of the world in a matter of hours, and the internet, which means we can see and supervise production anywhere on the earth as easily as we used to supervise it across the street from our office. Mm-hmm. Therefore, why the hell are we paying high U.S. wages? We can go to China, desperate for companies to come there, desperate for jobs for the masses of their people, and we can pay a small fraction of what we pay now. And the Chinese are well-educated. Their communist society has given them a stability of a workforce that is way better for us than what we can get, for example, in Latin America or Africa. And so we're off to China. Long story short, the United States now has a real competitor. It didn't have a real competitor for most of the post-Second World War period. They all were wiped out in the Second World War. The United States, other than Pearl Harbor, had no Second World War experience on its own soil. So it came out as King of the Hill afterwards. So you have the bubble in the stock market. You have the rising power of China now able to carry out its own high-tech industry. It doesn't need the United States. You can see it with the Huawei Corporation. You can see it across the board. The failure of the trade war, the failure of the tariffs. I mean, how many signs of failure do you need before you begin to understand, we're not prepared for this? And now to watch a country four times larger than the United States do an infinitely better job on COVID than we were able to do. I mean, the accumulation of signs, even for Biden and Trump, must be difficult to cope with. And so for me, I see the dot-com situation, the subprime mortgage situation, and now COVID. These were just the triggers. They were the thing that set off. But the important thing is a system that does this all the time. It's not important to fasten on the trigger. That's really childish. If I didn't have the three centuries of every 4 to 7 years a crisis, then maybe I could listen to an argument each time it's this particular thing. It's a little bit like, you know.
I want to ask you about China. I don't think you are saying this, but I want to clarify that you're not saying this. You said that China, as a communist country, was a lot more stable than the United States. And then you said they were a competitor to the United States. And while we were vulnerable to the cycles of crisis, you didn't say this, but you might infer that China is not. Do you think that China is communist, really? And do you think that China is immune to the kind of cycles of crisis that the United States is vulnerable to, and then Europe is vulnerable to, and the rest of the world as capitalists is vulnerable to?
The easiest part to answer is the last part first. No, the Chinese are not immune. They can't be. The Chinese decided 40 years ago to hitch their economic development program to the world economy, to become an enormously important exporter of all kinds of products. The minute you make that decision, fateful decision, you are going to be caught up in the cycles of global capitalism, whether you want to or not. In addition, so that's the first thing. They can't escape. They learned that, by the way. If you look at the statistics in 2008, they went down just like everybody else. If you look at the statistics of 2020, they went down like everybody else. They didn't go down as far, and they came back sooner. That's true, and that's important. But immune? No, they can't be immune. And that's not even going into their internal problems, which are also serious and which can also give them ups and downs. The more crucial question that you ask, and the more difficult one, is what does the word communism mean when it's applied to China? Well, first of all, they do not describe their society as communist. They never have. It's a peculiar Western tendency to do that. The same is true of the Soviet Union. They never described their society as communist. Both countries described their economies as socialist. And for them, that's an important distinction. It ought to be for the rest of the world, but it isn't for some reason that I could speculate on.
That's interesting that you would say that, because I wasn't sure reading your work with Resnick from the 80s whether you thought the distinction between socialism and communism is significant. Yeah. So we'll get to that in a little bit in the parrot room.
let me just finish this particular point.
Yeah.
Why is it important? For them, communism is a future state. They hope to get there. They perhaps believe they are en route to it, but they're crystal clear that they're not at it yet. They are at an earlier stage. It's post-capitalism, they want us to believe. It is an in-between that they call socialism. And by that, they seem to mean a massive role for the government. The government regulates private enterprise on the one hand, and the government substitutes or replaces private enterprise on the other. Countries vary into the proportion of those two. So if you go to Scandinavia, it's more socialism regulating private enterprise. If you go to the Soviet Union, it's kind of the other end of the spectrum. It's more government replacing private enterprise. But socialism is a mixture. If you know much about China, you'll know that they have gone much further than the Soviet Union ever did in allowing, in supporting, in financing private capitalist enterprises, particularly over the last 30 years, so that their economy is very much a mixture of private capitalist enterprises and state-owned and operated enterprises. So is it communist? No. Is it socialist? Well, in the way I've just described it, yes. Do I find this a meaningful difference? And my answer is no. And let me explain.
Okay.
It depends on what you mean, of course, by capitalist and socialist. If what you mean is the importance of the government, then I get it. Then I understand what they mean. They call themselves socialist because clearly they give a role to the government that is greater than what you find in countries like the United Kingdom or the United States, where the role of the government is less and the role of the private sector more. I get that. I understand. But for me, I don't find that persuasive or useful. I have a different definition, and I'll give it to you, and then I'll justify it. First, I give it to you. For me, the word capitalist is a description of how the production of goods and services is organized. I make distinctions, which many people do, between capitalism, feudalism, the system that preceded it in Europe, slavery, the system that preceded feudalism in Europe, and these are systems that have also existed elsewhere around the world. And these systems are distinguished one from the other by how they organize production. In the case of slavery, it's organized such that a minority, the masters, own the majority, the slaves. The slaves do the bulk of the work. The masters have all the power and accumulate the wealth. Then we go to feudalism. It is different because the people who run the society, still a minority, do not own the rest of the people. That's slavery. In feudalism, you have lords, a tiny minority, and the mass of people who do the work, they were called serfs. And the relationship of lord to serf is religiously sanctioned, is a kind of swearing of mutual obligation and responsibility. Slaves did not swear anything to the lord, to the master, that wasn't relevant. Then we come to capitalism. Capitalism doesn't have slavery. Nobody owns anybody. And capitalism doesn't have workers swearing to be loyal or swearing to bear responsibility. None of that. Instead, we have, again, a tiny minority. They're called employers. And a vast majority. They're called employees. And the relationship between them is a legal contract. I will give you X 40 hours a week of my brains and my muscles, and you will give me on Friday afternoon on my way home an envelope with my pay. And that's the deal we have, and we work all of that out. For me, that's what's distinctive about capitalism. Therefore, I am going to exaggerate now, Doug, just but to make it clear. I don't give a damn whether the employer is a state official or not, because what matters for me is the relationship between the employer and the employee. And now let me rationalize or justify it. If I were to say to you that in let's take American slavery before the Civil War, if I were to say to you, well, there were in Alabama or in Mississippi, there were more private masters and fewer governments who had slaves. But in Georgia and Louisiana, there were more government slaves than there were private slaves. I think your eyes would roll and you would say to me, I don't much care, because for me, the issue is slavery. That's the primary question. Do we want, do we keep, do we sustain slavery, or do we turn against it? Whether the slave master is a private citizen or occupies some position in a state bureaucracy is a much secondary matter. And I certainly heard no one ever say to me in all my years of university life that something that the system had changed the slave system because the proportion of private to state had been altered. Nobody says that. And nobody says it for feudalism either. Whether there's a government that has serfs, and that was very common, or it was private people who had serfs, and that was very common, nobody cares. It's not an important matter. So for me, I don't want to hear that we have a fundamental struggle in the 20th century between the state. I'm not interested in that. That's not my interest is in a system. And here's my radicalism, if you want it in a nutshell. My interest is in a system that breaks with all of these, for me, unjust, undemocratic dichotomies. Master-slave, lord-serf, employer-employee. For me, the socialism and the communism or any of these kinds of liberatory alternatives to capitalism, if they're going to mean something to me, they've got to talk to me about a reorganization of the workplace so that we don't have a small group of unaccountable people running the show. That we got rid of kings because we didn't want that in our politics. But you know what? The kings hid and fooled us. They moved inside the workplace and they reestablished their throne right there in the factory, the office, and the store. And we have to do to them there what we did to kings in the larger society, which is to abolish monarchy. But in this case, it means abolish capitalism, replace it with a different. On that scale, using that logic, My answer has to be China has not done that. Both the private enterprises that are a major part of the Chinese economy today and the state enterprises are organized in an employer-employee dichotomy.
Well, listen, Professor Wolf, I think this is where we're going to end the first half of our conversation. I hope you can stick around for a little while longer. I'm going to do is I do want you to say the name of your book again and tell people when it's on sale or if it's already available.
Yep.
Tell me the name of your book again.
Okay, here we go. It's a bit of a long title. It's called The Sickness is the System: When Capitalism Cannot Save Us from Pandemics or Itself. It was published by the organization I work with, Democracy at Work. And the easiest way to acquire it is simply to go to the website democracyatwork, all one word, .info. democracyatwork.info. You can order the book there. It's available both in print and also as an ebook. You can order it either way, whichever is more convenient to you. But it'll be an introduction to all these issues that Doug and I have been discussing over the last little while.
Great. And I'm going to go and refill my coffee cup. And then in about 5 to 10 minutes, I'll send you another link. We'll start, I think, the second half of this and maybe go for 40 minutes or so, because I know you're busy. But hopefully we'll go for as long as we need to. But we'll start with the question around the New Deal and how we should understand the New Deal. And actually, I'm going to ask you the question, but not let you answer it. Christopher Lash's book, in your book, you say that the 1930s were a time where the workers unified and they struggled and they really made a lot of advances. And the struggle for socialism was really strong at that point in American history. In Christopher Lash's book, The Agony of the American Left, he says that around 1919, the American socialists had already been split and were in total disarray, were devastated. And so I want to start there.
Good.
When we come back. Thanks for watching this Zero Books video. If you enjoyed it, subscribe to this channel and click on the notifications bell so that you'll be alerted whenever we release a new video. You should also consider supporting us on Patreon. Our patrons get access to our Inside Zero Books podcast every week and can get access to the Zero Books Book Club and help us to continue making online content from the left.